Iran strongly criticizes the mistreatment of its national by a Swedish court, saying it will spare no effort to protect its citizens anywhere in the world. Israeli forces killed two Palestinian youths across the occupied West Bank as tensions mount following the formation of the regime's most extremist cabinet. And a British union says over 100,000 of its members will go on strike after a dispute with the government over pay and job security remains unresolved. Hello everyone and thanks for tuning in to World News. Now, Iran has strongly criticized the mistreatment of one of its nationals by a Swedish court, saying it'll spare no effort to protect its citizens anywhere in the world. Iran's foreign ministry also reminded the Swedish government of the need to respect human, legal, and consular rights of the Iranian citizens jailed there. The ministry's statement referred to the plight of Hamid Nouri, an Iranian citizen imprisoned in Sweden over alleged rights abuses, and he was arrested back in 2019 on charges brought against him by the anti-Iran MKO terrorist group. Nouri has attended his appeals, or he attended an appeals court hearing this Wednesday, slamming his trial as unfair. He urged the judge not to hold a sham trial, saying that he will not attend further hearings until his problems are addressed. In reaction, the judge ordered his microphone turned off. Nouri has been humiliated, beaten, and denied access to medical services throughout his detention and trial period. President Ebrahim Raisi says that Iran is ready to play an active and constructive role in putting an end to the Ukraine war. He made the announcement in a phone call with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. The Iranian president said regional issues, including conflicts in Syria and the Caucasus, should only be resolved through cooperation among regional players, adding the Islamic Republic has always rejected foreign interference in the region. The Russian president, for his part, underlined that problems in Syria should be settled through the Astana talks. That was a peace format set up in January 2017 by Iran, Russia, and Turkey to find a solution to the Syria conflict. Wednesday has been another deadly day for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces killed two Palestinians amid heightened tensions following the formation of the regime's most extremist cabinet. In one incident, an Israeli settler fatally shot 19-year-old Sanad Mohammed Samasra near the city of Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron, that took place following an alleged stabbing attack. Meanwhile, Palestinian Health Ministry said the Israeli forces also shot 21-year-old Ahmed Amr Salim Abu Junaid in the head at the Balata refugee camp in the northern West Bank. He later succumbed to his injury at a hospital. That fatality came during a raid of the camp by Israeli forces. Reacting to the Israeli crimes, the Hamas resistance movement said the Palestinian people will continue to defend their land until final liberation. It added that operations against Israeli forces and settlers are in response to the regime's crimes against Palestinians. A major British union says 100,000 of its members will go on strike February 1st in dispute with the government over pay, pensions, and job security. Announcement came at a time the UK is experiencing a wave of strikes across all sectors, ranging from healthcare to railways. The Public and Commercial Services Union said it had warned the government the dispute will escalate if it does not listen. Union Secretary General added the dispute could be resolved if more money is offered to its members. Different government departments and public sector bodies are hit with strikes over the last month as pay rises fail to keep up with double-digit inflation. Now, thousands of ambulance workers held a second day of strikes Wednesday, while many schools in Scotland were closed due to a teacher walkout.
They took months to be held, but only hours to fail. Negotiations between unions and the UK government aimed at working out mainly pay deals to prevent another wave of public sector disruptions.
We are talking about people who are working well beyond their contracted hours anyway, just to get the job done because they can't hand patients over and because they care so much. So for the government to be talking about productivity in exchange for a pay award is an insult to every single one of our members.
An insult to his union members and perhaps to other public sector workers across the country, protesting against the government's refusal to give them pay rises that keep pace with inflation, which soared above 10% in October last year. The same month, public sector pay in real terms hit a 19-year low. But the government is digging in. Instead of making concessions, it has introduced controversial new legislation to Parliament designed to curb the impact of the strikes. Critics of the new bill are warning of the consequences. Without the desired pay offers from the government, those walkouts are bound to go ahead, with tens of thousands of transport workers, National Health Service staff, civil servants, and others set to take part in industrial action this month and beyond.
There are more strikes in the UK today than in more than a decade, driven by a cost of living crisis and a lack of inflation-matching pay rises. The unions are saying enough is enough, and that the only way for them to cease further industrial action is hard, cold cash. It remains to be seen if the UK government will be the first one to blink in this staring contest. Saeed Pourrezeb, London.
In France, unions and opposition parties have pledged to fight and derail an unpopular plan by President Emmanuel Macron's government to raise the retirement age. Unions who have the support of a left-wing coalition in Parliament have called for nationwide strikes and protests on January 19th. They consider this as one of the most brutal measures in the last three decades. That's why Macron's government says it is not afraid of the strikes and will stand its ground. Under the plan, the retirement age will be raised from 62 to 64 by the year 2030. People will also need to work longer to get a full pension. The government will formally adopt a proposal at a January 23rd cabinet meeting before it goes on to Parliament. France witnessed several protests last year against Macron's reforms. Ukraine says it will be able to win the war with Russia in 2023 if it receives more Western weapons, particularly long-range missiles and heavy tanks. An advisor to Ukraine's president said only missiles with a range of over 100 kilometers will allow Kiev to take Ukrainian territories back from Russia. Mykhailo Podolyak added, if Ukraine's demands are not met, the war will go on for decades. U.S. has already supplied Ukraine with missile systems with a range of around 80 kilometers. Kiev, however, is pressuring Washington to deliver missiles with a range of around 300 kilometers. They'll allow Ukraine's forces to target Russian arms depots deep inside Ukrainian territory controlled by Moscow. Russia has warned time and again that the continued supplies of Western arms will only prolong the war and increase the suffering of the Ukrainian people. Now in Brazil, thousands of rioters have attacked government institutions in a dangerous echo of the United States' January 6 insurrection. Police are now questioning some 1,000 protesters detained as calls for justice and accountability grow across a South American nation.
Police in Brazil have detained some 1,500 supporters of former President Jair Bolsonaro over attacks on government buildings at the weekend, as calls for justice and accountability grow across the South American nation. Most of the former far-right leader's backers were detained when law enforcement forces dismantled a protest camp in the capital, Brasilia, which many demonstrators set off from on Sunday before breaking into Congress, the Supreme Court, and the presidential palace. The administration of Brazil's new left-wing president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who was officially sworn in on January 1st, has pledged to investigate those behind the violence and hold them to account. Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes, who is running investigations of the anti-democratic protests, vowed in a speech on Tuesday to combat what he called the terrorists at work in Brasilia. Rioters broke windows, toppled furniture, and hurled computers and printers to the ground as they ransacked the government buildings on Sunday. They destroyed precious works of art, overturned the U-shaped table where Supreme Court justices convene, ripped a door off one justice's office, and vandalized a statue outside the court. Lula denounced what he called far-right acts of terrorism as he met the leaders of both houses of Congress and the head of the Supreme Court. He had also blamed Bolsonaro for instigating his supporters after a campaign of baseless allegations about the October election results. Lula has vowed to bring to justice those responsible for what he called the fascist assault and declared federal intervention in public security in the capital lasting until January 31st. The riot came after Lula, who previously served as Brazil's president from 2003 to 2010, narrowly defeated Bolsonaro in a hard-fought presidential election runoff on October 30th. Bolsonaro is a former army captain who has expressed admiration for the military regime that ruled Brazil from 1964 to 1985. For months, he had falsely claimed the country's electronic voting system was vulnerable to fraud. Sunday's riot in Brasilia also drew parallels to the January 6, 2021 riot at the U.S. Capitol, which saw a mob of former President Donald Trump's supporters storm the legislature in an effort to stop Congress from certifying his successor Joe Biden's election victory. Brazilian police were noticeably slow to react to the riot in Brasilia, even after the arrival of more than 100 buses, leading many to question whether authorities had either simply ignored numerous warnings, underestimated the protesters' strength, or been somehow complicit. Prosecutors in the capital said local security forces were negligent at the very least.
Now, some of Bolsonaro's supporters were hoping that the protests would trigger a military coup and result in the reinstatement of their defeated president. The pattern in South America in recent years has been lawfare against democratically elected governments and corruption accusations which may or may not be true. Also, claims of CIA involvement have spread in the media like wildfire. InfoWars owner Alex Jones suggested the riot was instigated by government informants disguised as Bolsonaro supporters.
In Brazil's capital on Sunday, thousands of protesters attacked government institutions in a dangerous echo of the United States' January 6 insurrection. Bolsonaro, dubbed as Tropical Trump, has questioned the credibility of the country's electronic voting system without providing evidence. Lula was sworn in on January 1st, unleashing a barrage of rebuke against Bolsonaro for what he called his predecessor's mishandling of Brazil's affairs during his mandate. There have been claims of the CIA involvement in what is seen as a failed coup in Brazil. If true, why would the CIA attempt to do so? To be sure, the CIA does have a long track record of staging coups in Latin America, but it has done so with the intent of dismantling leftist governments and installing far-right regimes. Brazil is set to reassert itself in global geopolitics alongside fellow BRICS states Russia, India, and China. Lula at the helm in Brazil, in what is now his third non-successive presidential term, will offer a tremendous boost to BRICS. In the 2000s, Lula was a key conceptualizer of a deeper role for BRICS, including trade in their own currencies. The U.S. is being slowly but surely expelled from wider Eurasia by concerted actions of the Russia-China strategic partnership. Ukraine is a black hole, where NATO faces a humiliation similar to what the U.S. faced in Afghanistan. A feeble EU being forced by Washington to deindustrialize and buy U.S. liquefied natural gas at absurdly high cost has no essential resources for the empire to plunder. Geoeconomically, that leaves the U.S.-denominated Western Hemisphere, especially immense energy-rich Venezuela, as the key target. And geopolitically, the key region actor is Brazil. The U.S. would seemingly try to pull all stops to prevent Chinese and Russian trade expansion and political influence in Latin America, which Washington, irrespective of international law and the concept of sovereignty, continues to call its backyard.
The South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has called for increased cooperation with Washington on the operation of U.S. nuclear assets to defend South Korea. Now, the U.S. has deployed strategic weapons capable of delivering nuclear payloads to South Korea in response to the North's missile tests. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol told journalists this week he wants to be more involved with the deployment of U.S. nuclear weapons to defend his country from North Korea.
We have not seen any results yet, but South Korea and the U.S. will cooperate in this system, which the U.S. has been operating unilaterally. Although nuclear assets are U.S. assets, South Korea will participate in their operation, and the two countries will work together to respond to the threat of North Korea's nuclear escalation.
President Yoon has resumed large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea war games and strengthened Seoul's alliance with Washington. However, U.S. President Joe Biden has so far stopped short of coordinating the deployment of nuclear weapons. The U.S. has conducted several missions to South Korea involving so-called strategic assets, weapons that can deliver nuclear bombs. Amid the South Korea-U.S. military buildup, civil society leaders meeting in Seoul this week called on President Yoon to make greater efforts to pursue dialogue with North Korea.
As promised by the Constitution, there must be dialogue and the establishment of mutual trust to carry out the development of peace. The people of the Korean Peninsula hope for a coexistence of the peninsula with the warm wind of peace, not a crisis-ridden Korean Peninsula with the energy of war hovering around.
Under the previous progressive president, Moon Jae-in, engagement with North Korea reduced tensions, which have only flared up again with the election of President Yoon and renewed North Korean missile tests in 2022.
South Korean peace activists say 2023, the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Korean War armistice, marks an occasion to increase their campaign to officially end the war. Meanwhile, President Yoon plans to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the South Korea-U.S. alliance with record-level military exercises. Frank Smith, Seoul.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., thousands of people are without electricity in California as it braces for the next onslaught of storms. At least six people have died since New Year and more than 560,000 homes are without power. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Los Angeles Times has covered the story and tells us more. California is bracing for another week of destructive storms that will probably bring flooding and hazardous winds on Monday to an already battered state. A series of atmospheric rivers that pummeled coastal communities last week and left more than 400,000 people without electricity in California on Sunday will be followed by particularly brutal weather as rivers reach flood levels and powerful winds wreak havoc, according to forecasters. We expect to see the worst of it in front of us, California Governor Gavin Newsom said on Sunday, 8th of January. We're anticipating very intense weather coming in on Monday and Tuesday morning. Governor Gavin Newsom asked the Biden administration to declare a federal emergency in California before the new weather arrives, saying that the most extreme conditions are expected in the first 48 hours of the week. Evacuation warnings or orders were issued in parts of Santa Clara, Alameda, Sacramento, Sonoma, Monterey, and Santa Cruz counties, with forecasters suggesting that swollen rivers could flood businesses and homes. San Jose officials were gearing up for what could be the worst flooding to hit the San Francisco Bay Area most populous city since the surprise flooding in 2017 of Coyote Creek, which forced more than 14,000 residents out of their homes. Water district officials warned of possible flooding in San Jose at the Guadalupe River near the Tamien station of the Caltrain commuter rail system, affecting the Northern Cross neighborhood, Ross Creek at Cherry Avenue south of downtown, and Upper Penitencia Creek near the North San Jose BART station. The Santa Clara Valley Water District on Sunday, 8th of January, issued an extreme weather alert. Flooding is possible in the coming days in Palo Alto, Menlo Park, Sunnyvale, Morgan Hill, and Gilroy, California. Evacuation warnings were issued downstream to two full reservoirs in Santa Clara County. The Uvas Reservoir northwest of Gilroy, whose water flows into Uvas Creek, and the Pacheco Reservoir, which empties into Pacheco Creek alongside Highway 152, a main route between the San Francisco Bay Area and Interstate 5. Evacuation warnings in Santa Cruz County include the towns east and southeast of Santa Cruz, including Soquel, Sea Creek, Rio del Mar, and Watsonville, which borders the Pajaro River. Monterey County Sheriff Tina Nieto said the Carmel and Big Sur rivers will probably reach flood stage on Monday and the Salinas River on Tuesday. Evacuation warnings were issued along the Carmel Valley, where the Carmel River could flood. Alameda County issued evacuation warnings for the hills east of Hayward and Fremont and west of Pleasanton. Sacramento County issued an evacuation order for the Wilton area along the Consumers River, whose waters breached levees over New Year's Eve, killing three motorists whose bodies were found in or near submerged cars near Highway 99. As of Sunday afternoon, 8th of January, 424,000 customers were without electricity in California, according to the state's Office of Emergency Services. More than 375,000 customers lost their power in Northern California overnight on Saturday, 7th of January, as the latest powerful winter storm pushed through the region, elevating the danger for flooding and bringing intense winds that downed trees. In the Sacramento area, one of the hardest hit regions, wind gusts topped 60 miles per hour and caused many to lose their power, according to the National Weather Service. Utility officials have been working to restore electricity and said it will take some time. Pacific Gas and Electric deployed 4,000 crew members dedicated to storm restoration. Their own personnel, contractors, and mutual aid from Southern California and as far away as Wyoming and Canada. "We're just getting repeatedly pounded by storm after storm," said Tracy Correa Lopez, a spokeswoman for Pacific Gas and Electric. "Flooding is an issue. The number one issue right now is access to a lot of these areas." The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. Torrential downpours and damaging winds left hundreds of thousands of homes and businesses without electricity in California early on Sunday, 8th of January, as the area braced for the next onslaught of severe weather. More than 560,000 homes were reported to be still without electricity in California as of Sunday afternoon, according to data from PowerOutage.us. At least six people have died in the severe weather since New Year's weekend, including a toddler killed by a fallen redwood tree crushing a mobile home in Northern California. Forecasters have meanwhile warned yet another atmospheric river of dense, moist tropical air will clobber California on Monday, 9th of January, with rain and mountain snow. That weather is just the first of five approaching atmospheric rivers, a stream of storms that will continue until about 19th of January, and they will arrive in the state this weekend. An NWS weather alert on Saturday, 7th of January, warned that the cumulative effect of successive heavy rainstorms since late December could bring rivers to record high levels and cause flooding across much of central California. The heavy recent rains have had a huge impact on the state and caused rivers and streams to overflow and send floods down streets and highways and submerging vehicles, homes and businesses. The storms have also whipped waves to historic heights along California's coastline. Drought-hit California had been on track for another dry winter until the stacked atmospheric rivers came into play. However, most experts believe that California will need a lot more water before the long-term drought could be considered meaningfully broken.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends, and let us reflect on what the Prophet's divinely designated heir, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, has said about prosperity in life and salvation in afterlife. Charity is an effective cure, and the actions of people in their present life will be before their eyes in the next life.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is the show A to Z. For today's program, Brother Muhammad is going to talk to us about Islamic education. Stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In today's discussion with regards to Islamic education, we would like to look at an important aspect of the life of a Muslim. And this is, in fact, one of the important practices in the Islamic faith, and that is the prayer, Salah. Salah is such an important aspect of religion that it is called the pillar of faith. And indeed, inculcating and educating our children with regards to Salah is an important responsibility of the parents. The parents need to realize that on one hand, there are different ways they can go about teaching Salah, but the most important way is the practical role modeling of Salah. Indeed, when the parents themselves stand to pray, the children get interested in what is going on and they would like to emulate their parents in Salah. Now, on one hand, apart from emulating it, it's not necessary for us to force them, as the process of nurturing salah needs to be done over a span of time with important introductions and reminders at stages along the way. And the children need to be taken slowly and gradually without any extremism, without any excess, and thereafter slowly guiding them to the process of salah. One of the very important ways of teaching the details of salah is, again, role modeling and practically showing and demonstrating the different acts of salah. We find in the traditions and the lifestyle of the Ma'sumin alayhim as-salam, the holy infallibles, that they would likewise take the time out and explain and demonstrate for their followers or those who come to ask the precise method of praying salah. And this is again very important, because when the observer is observing the demonstration, they look at fine details as well. And the demonstrator as well has an opportunity to lay out the defined details and place reminders here and there to grab the attention of the listener. Now, on one hand, we find Rasulullah himself, when he began the process of salah and teaching it to the Muslims, when salah became an obligation on them, Rasulullah stood for prayer and he said, "Sallu kama ra'aytumuni usalli." Pray just like you see me praying. And indeed, Rasulullah, when he would pray, he would not only pray with the wajibat, but he would pray with the mustahabbat. And truly, Rasulullah's state would change when he would be praying salah. And indeed, this was a source of inspiration, the fountainhead of salah, the person who had the most perfect salah, teaching the Muslims how to pray salah. And indeed, the Muslims learned from that and they implemented it in their lives. When we look at the lifestyle and the traditions from the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, we find that the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam would, on one hand, not only encourage their companions to pray salat, but as time would pass and as they would grow older, the expectations would grow as well. And they would expect their companions to be praying salah with its etiquette. But when it came to introducing and demonstrating salah, we have a tradition from Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam that his companion Hammad came to him. And he said, "Oh Imam, can you please show me how to pray salah?" And Imam stood with a very straight, erect posture, and he stood facing the Qibla, and he placed his hand on his thighs, and his feet were together with a span of 3 fingers between them, and they were all facing towards the Qibla without any deviation, and with all humility and attention, he stood and said, "Allahu Akbar." And he recited Surah Al-Hamd, Surah Al-Fatiha, and Surah Al-Tawheed. And he recited them with tartil, with recitation in measured tones. And thereafter, after completing the recitation of the surahs, he paused for refreshing his breath, and he said, "Allahu Akbar." And he raised his hands near his face and he went into ruku'. And thereafter, the tradition continues in such detail. It tells us exactly how Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam prayed salah. When he bent for ruku', his back was straight, such that not a single drop, if it fell on his back, would go in any specific direction. And thereafter, he recited Subhana Rabbi al-Azim wa bihamdi. He stood up again straight without any bendings. When he stood up straight again, he said, "Sami Allahu liman hamida," and said, "Allahu Akbar," and went again into the state of sujood. And when he placed his hands, he made sure the 7 body parts that are supposed to be on the ground were specifically on the ground. And this is where he even told Hammad that, "Oh Hammad, these are 7 parts of the body that must be on the ground. And as the verse of the Holy Quran says, وَأَنَّ الْمَسَاجِدَ لِلَّهِ فَلَا تَدْعُوا مَعَ اللَّهِ أَحَدًا. He said the masajid here refers to the seven parts of the body that need to be on the ground. And Imam alayhi salam continued, and Hammad is documenting this salah of Imam al-Sadiq in such detail that if a person even today was to read this, he can actually picture exactly how the demonstration by Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam was presented. So indeed, we learn from this tradition that when we are teaching our children how to pray, let's not just expect them to watch us on our own salah, on our own when we pray our salah. Rather, we should take the time out and we should demonstrate to them each and every detail of salah properly with explanations such that the children themselves are able to pray salah. Let's not leave it on the madrasa or the school or another person. Rather, it is important on ourselves as parents to take the time out and pray salah properly and make sure our children are able to pray salah properly. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Until next time, fi amanillah, under God's protection.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
The story of the sky.
Part one.
From 3,500 years before the birth of Jesus Christ until the late 20th century, about 14,500 wars have broken out and over 3 billion people have lost their lives due to wars. Only 300 years of history of mankind have actually passed in peace. This is what Conway Henderson says in his book. Ever since its emergence, the U.S. government has been a pioneer of wars all over the world by directly or indirectly waging wars in 37 countries. The current figures on the U.S. military conflicts after World War II show that Washington's so-called plans to expand liberty have sent 20 to 30 million people to their graves. This is why military experts believe that for every one person that's killed in any war, there are 10 more people injured. This means the U.S. has so far caused incidents similar to the 9/11 attacks 10,000 times in different parts of the world. By looking into the U.S. background since its emergence, we don't see anything other than a bleak and bloody history of aggression, except for a few years. The fact of the matter is that West Asia was a focal point for the U.S. because of its strategic importance and the political geography and energy resources needed in the world. The U.S. military bases in the southern Persian Gulf littoral states, Turkey, Iraq, and Afghanistan, are proof.
But there's only one reason for the U.S. presence in the region and its special attention to it, and that is Iran. In 1979, Iran shattered the political equations of the White House with its Islamic Revolution. Iran's progress during the 8-year war with Iraq, especially in its missiles industry, was beyond imagination, and it left the U.S. bewildered and, of course, worried more than any other country. Soon, Iranian missiles range reached the U.S. beating heart in the region, namely Tel Aviv. So, the alarm had now sounded for the Yankees to do something.
Iran aggressively pursues these weapons and exports terror. States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world.
On September 11th, 2001, the Twin Towers in New York collapsed after a fabricated scenario, and it paved the path for the U.S. to officially launch the military deployment to West Asia. So, the U.S. Army invaded Afghanistan on Sunday, October 7th, 2001, with its full military force. Two years later, on March 30th, 2003, the U.S. waged a new war in the region with its military aggression against Iraq under the pretext of another unfounded claim that Saddam Hussein's regime was making weapons of mass destruction. Yet, despite all of this, the question is, why would the U.S. send its military forces thousands of miles away from home? That's why, after 2002, the Pentagon allocated a huge budget for construction, equipping, and expansion of ground, naval, and air bases in the Persian Gulf and adjacent regions. The U.S. has 21 bases in 6 Persian Gulf Arab states that are currently the largest bases to provide the U.S. troops in the region with facilities and equipment. Among the 6 Persian Gulf nations, Kuwait hosts 6 U.S. bases. Although it is a small base, it gives the U.S. the largest access for facilities in the region. After Kuwait, Qatar hosts the highest number of bases for the terrorist U.S. Army. Oman and the United Arab Emirates didn't want to be left behind, so they also handed over swaths of their land to the Yankees. The U.S. adventurism in the region shows that with hundreds of intelligence units on the ground and thousands of hours of drone flights, they are supposed to control the region in a way that they do not miss any event in the region. These are only a few examples of the reasons behind U.S. military presence with its full force in the region to counter Iran. Concurrent with the military campaign, they piled pressure on Iran through diplomatic means and imposed missile and nuclear activities related sanctions to tighten the noose around the country. Iran's missile power would stop the U.S. from causing insecurity despite its muscle flexing in the region.
Every time I think about those kids.
That caused fury for the officials at the White House more than anything else. So they opted for the next option on the table. During all those years they were in Iraq, they churned out a new generation of murderers in the format of the Daesh terrorist group in their prisons, especially in Camp Buka, and triggered widespread bloodbaths and destruction in a large part of the region.
I call President Obama and Hillary Clinton the founders of ISIS. They're the founders. You get the MVP award. ISIS will hand her the most valuable player award. Her only competition is Barack Obama, between the two.
Muslims in the region, who were supposed to unite hands for the liberation of Palestine, were now at each other's throats after the accurately calculated scheme. So the occupied territories became a safer place for the Zionists. Costly arrangements in Iraq and Syria were made for the big cause, namely occupation of Iran. But they had overlooked this part of the plan. Reinforcing and reorganizing the formidable wall of the axis of resistance through the Islamic Republic of Iran's support. Anyways, the White House officials couldn't easily overcome the challenge, and the U.S. did not achieve a remarkable victory through this tactic either. Bearing the failures and Iran's invincibility had become harder for them. They decided to use Takfiri and MKO terrorist agents inside of Iran. Like their attacks on Iran's parliament, Imam Khomeini's shrine, and the army parade in Ahvaz. But it seems they had forgotten again that the fireworks would incur a huge wrath. The IRGC forces know full well what makes arrogant powers more enraged, so that's what they do against the enemies, so they'll taste the defeat more bitterly. Iran once again flaunted its missile power to the world, so they won't get any ideas about doing anything stupid. Now, in response to any aggression, Iran will level their bases to the ground with its ballistic missiles with pinpoint accuracy. After 8 years of destruction and cold-blooded carnage of civilians, Daesh had no achievement for the U.S. after the huge costs. And it meant a new hard defeat for the U.S. in its adventurism in West Asia.
$7 trillion, not billion, not million. $7 trillion with a T. Nobody ever heard of the word trillion until 10 years ago. We spent $7 trillion in the Middle East.
Special images taken by IRGC Aerospace Forces experts from U.S. spy drones show the United States' all-out support for the terrorists in the region. The U.S. could not stand to see Iran's achievements against its terrorist groups. This time around, it bit off more than it could chew. Donald Trump's advisors had decided to revive the moribund maximum pressure campaign with a military shock. The best shock would be to eliminate one of the most important factors of the failure of U.S. policies in West Asia.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
At 1:20 a.m., Friday, January 3, 2020, something happened that shouldn't have.
Last night, at my direction, the United States military successfully executed a flawless precision strike that killed the number one terrorist anywhere in the world, Qasem Soleimani.
Trump, who was filled with fear, claimed responsibility for the attack. Yet, despite all of this, the gambler president threatened that in case Iran responded, 52 targets in Iran will be hit. The blatant rudeness had to be responded to quickly. Early morning on Wednesday, January 8th, 2020, at 1:20 a.m., 13 Qiyam and Fateh 313 ballistic missiles were fired from Kermanshah and destroyed a part of U.S. Ain al-Assad base located in the western Al-Anbar province in Iraq.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The post-Cold War world had long been crumbling, and after the year 2022, it's finally gone. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, the year 2022 came to an end. It has been a year which has significant consequences for the future of global geopolitics and will be remembered as such in the history books. Specifically, it marked the closing of the three decades of American unipolarity, which had begun with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 and forced through a new multipolar world consisting of numerous competing great powers. When the USSR fell in 1991, the US regime entered a period of unprecedented dominance, whereby it finalized its position as the global hegemon. Its political, economic, and military power was unparalleled, and as such, it had free rein to shape the global order to its liking. It is no surprise that in this period, the US did not pursue great power competition, but actively vested itself in a scores of regime change operations across every continent as it sought to implement what George H.W. Bush described as the New World Order. This included wars in Iraq, former Yugoslavia, Libya, Afghanistan, and Syria, to name but a few. Likewise, it was able to use its undisputed power over institutions such as the United Nations to pile sanctions on countries who defied its will. Owing to the hubris of its Cold War victory in the belief in the inevitability of its ideology or the end of history, the US during this period did not seek to counter states such as Russia or China precisely because it believed, at least initially, that these states were on a predetermined path to westernization and liberalization. As such, the US actively promoted globalization through free trade and investment, perceiving these countries as a vehicle for its own values. Fast forward to 2022, and the last remnants of these premature hopes have been swept away. Although long in the making, the past 12 months marked the ultimate consolidation of a new geopolitical era. Russia's military operation in Ukraine proved to be a decisive turning point, which represented the final break from the world established by the fall of the USSR. The main catalyst of this shift was the US itself, which no longer liked what the globalization it was once championing was now providing, that being the depletion of its hegemony through the resurgence of rival states which did not reform to its liking, including Russia and China. Seeing the rise of these countries which had, through America's own approval, integrated themselves within the global economy and prospered, but not adopted the American values as anticipated. The US veered back towards great power competition and began to provoke geopolitical conflict with a view to reasserting control over its wayward allies. This became extremely obvious in the foreign policy of the Biden administration, which sought to take an uncompromising approach to the expansion of NATO, igniting the conflict in Ukraine, which also aggressively accelerating attempts to contain China through the creation of new alliance systems such as AUKUS and escalating tensions over the Taiwan Strait. These actions by America have changed the world. While the average Westerner, deceived by the mainstream media discourse, blames Putin, the reality is the US regime is the one that has actively dismantled the post-Cold War 1991 international order precisely because it believes it now comes at the expense of American power. Part of this is the effort to actively roll back globalization. By creating geopolitical conflict, the U.S. strives to reassert its military influence while forcing